It's All Things Considered on 91.9 FM WUOT. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. Half a century ago, Tennessee and other southern states looked a little different. If you were a person of color, signs dictated the right building entrance to use, the correct water fountain, the right restroom, and more importantly, the wrong places, the places you couldn't go. Those areas were reserved for white people only. 50 years ago this summer, less than a lifetime ago, all that began to change. That was the summer a headstrong president and a divided Congress passed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, a landmark piece of legislation chronicled in Todd Purdom's new book, An Idea Whose Time Has Come. Earlier today, I spoke with Purdom about this historic law and the people who helped shape it. Obviously, there's an anniversary tie to the book, doing it now 50 years after. It's always an important time to look back on things that have happened and where we've come. But what specifically inspired you to start working on this book at this time?
Well, it really was the anniversary. But as I began my research, I realized just what a contrast there would be between the way Washington worked then and the way it's not working now. And while I don't beat the reader over the head with any overt comparison in the book, I think those differences do shine through. So it seemed to me that might be a good time to take a look at an era when things seem to be more functional, and it might land in our current mess with some resonance that people would find, you know, relevant. So I wish I could say that I started out of, you know, knowing a whole lot about it. I really didn't, and as my research proceeded, I learned just how much I didn't know about this whole story.
It took President Kennedy quite a while to come around on civil rights as a legislative priority. Why did it take him so long to be convinced that his administration should be involved in the civil rights struggle?
Well, because he had a whole range of other priorities as president, including a big tax cut, which he viewed as an economic stimulus measure. And all those plans and programs depended on the Southern bulls who ran the Congress in both houses for support. And he did not want to needlessly, as he saw it, alienate them by too strong support for civil rights. So while he'd campaigned in 1960 on a very strong civil rights platform, as Richard Nixon also had, he really temporized and hesitated in his early months in office until events forced his hand.
Early in the book, you write about one of those events. You tell a gripping story of James Meredith, who was the first African-American to enroll at Ole Miss at that time. That was in the fall of 1962, and things did not go well. Mississippi's governor, Ross Barnett, fanned public flames of antagonism. The state troopers who were supposed to be protecting Meredith were mysteriously called down, and a riot broke out on campus. Kennedy ordered army troops in from Memphis, but it took him hours to get there. And at one point, you have him, you know, screaming into the telephone, "Where's the army?" Now, how did all of that, from the recalcitrant Southern governors to the seeming incompetence of the federal government to do something about it, how did all of that influence Kennedy's evolution on the issue?
Well, it really began to change his view of the situation. It really began to make him realize that something would have to change. And so by the time of the following spring, when the brutal demonstrations in Birmingham rolled around and police dogs and fire hoses were knocking children to the ground and tearing their clothes off, President Kennedy was outraged by those pictures, as the world was outraged. And so he knew that he would have to do something. He knew that he would have to at last propose the comprehensive law he'd been reluctant to propose. And on June 11th, 1963, when the University of Alabama was integrated, just as peacefully as the violence had been in Ole Miss, in contrast, Kennedy chose that day, a day when there had been sort of a quiet victory, to make his speech proposing the bill.
And where it took President Kennedy about 3 years to come around on civil rights, at least from a legislative perspective, Lyndon Johnson took office, of course, in November of that year, and just 5 days after taking office, went to Congress and said, "This is going to be a legislative priority of mine. We're going to pass this civil rights bill." Why did Johnson take much quicker action on it than President Kennedy had?
Well, two things. He knew that he had to take quick action on civil rights if he was going to have a prayer of being taken seriously as president, if he could do the rest of the agenda he cared so much about, the social programs that eventually became the Great Society, Medicare, Medicaid, aid to education, and so forth. But out of public view, Johnson's views on race and civil rights had also been quietly evolving. In the spring of 1963, he'd made a series of speeches that actually went well beyond anything President Kennedy had yet said to that point in terms of supporting change, saying, "We can't wait any longer. We've waited 100 years since the Civil War." And unlike President Kennedy, Johnson had actually had some experience with poverty and privation, and he had taught Mexican school children in Texas. And he said, as he would later recall, that you never forget what hate can do to the eyes of a child. So I think in a strange way, since he was mostly seen as the person who had weakened the civil rights bills in 1957 and 1960 to get them through the Senate, He was quite a passionate supporter of civil rights by the time he took office. And he, as he said in that speech, he knew that no memorial or funeral oration could be a more fitting tribute than passing the bill, which Kennedy had worked so long for.
Johnson's efforts to carry the Civil Rights Act through Congress might have all been for naught had it not been for one man whose name is far less well known to us than that of Kennedy or King or Johnson. So tell us about the gentleman from Ohio, Congressman William McCulloch, and why he was so critical to the passage of the Civil Rights Act.
Well, he was a small town lawyer from West Central Ohio. His hometown of Piqua is represented today by Speaker John Boehner. He was a classic Midwestern conservative, against federal aid to education, against gun control, skeptical about foreign aid. He never spent more on a campaign than his annual salary. He turned back part of his office allowance every year because he was so frugal. But he was a passionate supporter of civil rights. He'd been descended from abolitionists before the Civil War. And as a young lawyer out of Ohio State, he'd practiced law briefly in Jacksonville, Florida, and seen what he thought were the cruel indignities of Jim Crow. So as the bill came around, he was the ranking Republican on the House Judiciary Committee. And when the Kennedy administration proposed the bill, McCulloch made a deal. He said, if you promise not to weaken this bill in the Senate and water it down, as has been the usual practice, and, unbelievably enough, if you promise to give us Republicans equal credit going into next year's presidential election, I'll bring along the Republican caucus in the House in support of this bill. And that's what happened. And it also had the effect of forcing first the Kennedy administration and then President Johnson to try something that had never before succeeded, which was to break a filibuster on civil rights and cut off debate in the Senate. And that's what also happened.
Looking at today's congressional environment, it would be highly unusual for someone to make that kind of offer, to offer to reach across the aisle.
Absolutely.
And work together. Was it as surprising in 1964 when McCulloch made that proposal?
It was unusual. It wasn't as surprising, partly because the Republicans at that point still took very seriously their heritage as the party of Lincoln. And for most of the 20th century, to the degree that civil rights had really been a major national issue at all, for either party, it had been a Republican issue. And in 1960, the Republican Party platform was really just as strong as the Democrats. So it wasn't radical in the sense that it would be today, but it was still very unusual in the sense that the Republicans could well have stuck it to the president, both Kennedy and Johnson, and said, your problem is you can't get your own house in order on civil rights. Why should we help you? And in essence, by cooperating, the Republicans removed this as a political football in the 1964 election instead of making it into a terribly divisive issue, which they easily could have done.
Barry Goldwater, another prominent Republican senator who was running for the presidency that year, voted against the Civil Rights Act. What were some of his objections to the bill?
Yes, he was one of only six Republican senators in the end to vote against the bill. And he did so, I think it's safe to say, not out of racist motives, but out of the kind of Western libertarian streak that later led him to say that he didn't care whether gays served openly in the military because it didn't matter whether you were straight as long as you could shoot straight. He feared the kind of national police force and an informer mentality. And he was worried about the private property rights of individuals who would be compelled to serve people regardless of race. And he felt that was an invasion of private property rights. And he wasn't alone in that regard. I mean, many of the bill's critics felt that at the time. Many of the criticisms that were leveled against the Affordable Care Act when President Obama proposed it really come from the same strain in American life of we don't want the government interfering. We don't want the government forcing us to buy health insurance or serve someone we don't want to serve. So that was really Goldwater's motivation. But the fact that he was the party's nominee and had been in the minority on this question had an unfortunate effect on the party's fortunes going forward, because it really did begin the process of transforming the party from the party of Lincoln into what it has remained to this day in a real way in the South, and that's the party of white backlash.
When the Civil Rights Act passed in that summer of 1964, there were predictions of violence. Some Southern Democrats who railed against it said there'd be a backlash from their white constituents, and even Bobby Kennedy said there'd be some unrest. What was the actual reaction that summer?
Well, the actual reaction was that it was very widely and swiftly accepted almost everywhere. There were pockets of resistance, but partly because it had passed so overwhelmingly, 73-27, with 27 of 33 Republican votes in the Senate, no one could say that it was a narrow victory. Again, in contrast to the Affordable Care Act, no one could say this had been rammed down anyone's throats. And the Southern senators, led by Richard Russell of Georgia, were the first to say basically that because of the strategy of Hubert Humphrey and Mike Mansfield and others, the Democratic leaders of the bill, they'd had their say, and they could go home to their constituents and say, look, we've lost fair and square. We did everything we could. And I think that had an enormous effect on making the bill be accepted. Within months, the central provision, the public accommodation section mandating desegregation of hotels and restaurants and so on, had been upheld by the Supreme Court. So it really, considering the radical nature of the law and the huge changes it was imposing, and that it had taken 100 years since the Civil War to get the job done, it was really remarkably accepted very quickly.
You write that Everett Dirksen of Illinois, prominent Republican senator and a man who was brought in to help give feedback and modify the bill to some extent to make it a little more palatable, included provisions that would ensure the Civil Rights Act and its provisions would apply more directly to the South than states in the North, because some of those states already had on the books anti-discrimination laws. So how was the law received here in the South?
Well, it was received as a kind of punitive law in the South, in large quarter of the South, and the Southerners saw Senator Dirksen's strategy for what it was. He was from Illinois, which, as you say, already had laws like this on the books. And from his perspective, he didn't want to see the small businessman, as he saw it, harassed by two sets of record-keeping requirements, one for a state law, one for the federal law. So he basically proposed changes that would allow states that already had their own laws on the books to get first crack at enforcement, in particularly employment discrimination. And that had the effect of really targeting the bill to the South. And the Southerners saw this as an effort to win support from Dirksen's fellow Midwesterners to cut off debate. And of course, that's exactly what it was intended to do and what it succeeded in doing. So I think there was a good deal of resentment in the South because, let's face it, Brandon, I mean, the bill and subsequent efforts have really left untouched in important ways the de facto segregation in the North that endures in Chicago or Boston or Washington or you name it.
Talk to me then about how people since the Civil Rights Act of 1964 have dealt with the de facto segregation that you're talking about.
Well, you know, there have been a whole series of efforts beginning in the late 60s to apply race-conscious remedies, whether that was busing or what we came to be known as affirmative action. And now we see just yesterday the Supreme Court is in the middle of, you know, that debate all over again on the question of college admissions and whether race preferences can be used in college admissions, and the court says they cannot. So I think that's been a battle, and it's actually the divisions over questions like that are partly what have fractured the consensus on civil rights. Paradoxically, the passage of the 64 Act and the Voting Rights Act the following year not only marked an enormous achievement, but in a way the last achievement, the last moment of real consensus and cooperation on this question. And as the 60s went on, those good feelings and that common cause really began to splinter, and we see the results of that to this day.
You write that at the ceremony on July 2nd, 1964, where President Johnson put his name to the bill, made it federal law, Bobby Kennedy was morose. If this was a bill that was supported by his late brother, introduced by his late brother whom he loved and respected very much, why was he so down at the bill signing ceremony when it actually came to fruition?
I think because his brother wasn't there to sign it. It wasn't there to take the credit. Attorney General Kennedy gave some pens that President Johnson had used to sign the bill to colleagues in the Justice Department with an inscription, "Pen used to sign President Kennedy's civil rights bill." So at that point, his relationship with Lyndon Johnson had become so corrosive and so bitter, and it dated back for many years, their sort of mutual animosity. But the people said that the one sort of bittersweet part of that signing ceremony, which was otherwise such a happy occasion, was to look at his face and see that he seemed really quite blue. And I think it's, you know, it's visible, very visible in the pictures of the event.
Lyndon Johnson's reaction to the bill's success was perhaps characteristic for Lyndon Johnson, polarized. Immediately after the signing, he was ebullient, shaking hands, handing out pens, everything was great. But several hours later, you write that Press Secretary Bill Moyers found him splayed out across his bed in the private residence portion of the White House, looking pretty glum himself. When Moyers asked him what was wrong, he said, "Bill, I fear that we've handed the South to the Republican Party for years to come." We know now today, of course, that Southern politics is dominated at many levels by the Republican Party, but how much of that is traceable to the Civil Rights Act? Was Johnson right?
Well, I think Johnson was right in an important way. Recent scholars have come to the conclusion that a lot of demographic trends were already underway that were helping the South trend Republican, especially in suburban areas and, you know, the outer cores that we see like in places around Atlanta to this day. But I think it was interesting that President Johnson was not, at the end of the day, completely euphoric. He saw that this was going to prompt a sort of tectonic shift in the political alignment of the country. And in fact, there are still Southern Democrats today. They're just Republicans. And our country's politics are polarized in very much the same way they were 50 years ago, although the nomenclature of the parties is different.
Shifting forward now half a century to the present day, there are still battles that are being fought, and you've alluded to some of these about the Supreme Court and the affirmative action decision that was made yesterday, or the decision to hear it, and the issues that it raised, the Civil Rights Act. You write that its passage gave some hope to other groups of people, from women to Hispanics to gays and lesbians who were looking for different treatment in society. So how do you place the Civil Rights Act in the context of 21st century America? How's it still relevant? How's it outdated? What does it look like today?
Well, I think it really is safe to say that it's the law that created modern America. It's the law that gave us the country we have today. That it hasn't finished the job, but it addressed the unfinished business that had lingered 100 years from the Civil War. And as former Secretary of State Colin Powell has been quick to note, the Civil Rights Act liberated not only black Americans from the yoke of discrimination, but white Americans as well from the burden of enforcing and being part of this really pernicious system that caused all kinds of unfairnesses and indignities and anomalies in daily life. And I think, you know, my own children who are 10 and 14 years old really have no understanding. My daughter's studying it in school. She's ready to take a trip next week actually to the South, to the sort of shrines of the Civil Rights Movement. But I don't think she has a visceral understanding that within my lifetime, you know, people were denied service in restaurants and motels and so forth simply because of the color of their skin. And as John Lewis, the congressman from Georgia, who was a young leader in the movement at the time, is quick to note, those days are never coming back again, and those white and colored signs are never going to be seen again except in a museum.
You said at the beginning of our conversation that you started out with not a deep or very intricate understanding of the Civil Rights Act and the political machinations that brought it to life. What was the most surprising thing you learned in doing the research for the book?
Well, I guess I would say three things. One is just how overwhelmingly it was supported on a bipartisan basis. I knew it was a bipartisan bill. I come from Illinois, so I certainly knew of Senator Dirksen's role. I didn't realize the incredible lopsided nature of the bipartisan cooperation. That was one. The second, I hadn't really understood what a widespread grassroots movement there was among interfaith groups, church groups of every stripe, to put very strategic pressure on members of Congress, particularly members from the Midwest and Great Plains states who didn't have large black constituencies and would have no natural political motivation to support the bill, but would be susceptible to an appeal from their pulpit, their priest, their rabbi. And that strategy proved to be lethally effective. And I didn't really understand the depth and breadth of that. And finally, in popular myth, the bill is seen as the work of Dr. King's, you know, brave protests, President Kennedy's assassination, and President Johnson's legislative skill. And while President Johnson clearly gets a lot of credit for never wavering, backing the strongest possible bill in public and private, never seeking to compromise, or as he had in the past, water the bill down, the record clearly shows that in the day-to-day realities of the debate, President Johnson had to hang back, not be too involved. He knew that it could backfire if he tried to pressure his former colleagues in the Senate. And the real leadership role on the bill day-to-day in the Senate was taken by Hubert Humphrey, the floor manager for the Democrats, and the majority leader, Mike Mansfield, and their very able staffs, who worked closely with the Republicans to make sure that they could create this grand coalition that could defeat the Southerners and, in a sense, turn all the energy of the Southern filibuster back against them in almost a jujitsu-like move through sheer patience, good manners, willingness to let the other side have its day and have its say. And the record shows that President Johnson was chomping at the bit and chafing at this strategy, but I think it's also safe to say that it was this patient, painstaking strategy that succeeded in the end.
Todd Purdom is the author of the brand new book, An Idea Whose Time Has Come, which chronicles the political struggle and the social struggle behind the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Todd, thanks for being with us today on All Things Considered.
Thanks so much for having me.